Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Devinder Hardwar.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Bernauer.
We're coming to you live on Geeks of Doom, as we do every week. And this week, we're going to talk about Facebook's $1 billion purchase of mobile phone startup Instagram and whether or not that portends another tech bubble.
Indeed. Mobile photo startup, yeah.
Plus, is the age of cheap cell phones over? But first, let's take a look at some of this week's top tech headlines. And I'm going to start with a little bit of a sad note here. Jack Tramiel, founder of Commodore International and crucial figure in the early history of personal computers, passed away on this last Sunday. He was 83 years old. Tramiel started a typewriter repair business, and eventually that morphed into calculators and later computers. And Commodore International launched the Commodore 64, which went on to be the best-selling personal computer of all time. In 1984, after being forced to leave the company he founded, Jack bought the crumbling Atari Inc.'s consumer division and formed Atari Corporation. And Tramiel was personally influential for me because I was an early, like, I bought those early Atari personal computers, like the Atari 800 and the Atari ST. Like when after Atari had their huge heyday with the 2600, with the, you know, the video game system, and their salad days were behind them, and they were getting into personal computing, and it was like shaky ground for them, and you know, they were entering a field that was already dominated by Amiga and the Amigas and the Macintoshes and the IBMs. At that point, they were really getting into kind of risky territory. I took a risk with them.
Taking risks.
Yeah.
Andrew Cercini.
I'd never had a Commodore 64. I had an awful lot of other early computers. But it's hard to underrepresent just how important they were for the early PC industry.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think Mac would be where it is now if it didn't have the if the Commodore 64 hadn't been as influential as it was.
Yeah.
Right.
Speaking of,
good competition, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So really push for the PC market. Still a great screen. I know even into the early 2000s, some people who are still using their screens instead of monitors at the moment, because they were just really, really good monitors. This is before flat screens. Obviously, once flat screens came out, really wasn't the same thing. But when I was in high school, one of my friends was using a Commodore 64 monitor, and he claimed it was far better than the ones he could get for the same price on the market.
I think he was kind of a crazy person.
Yeah.
Well, this is also
I've seen those screens, man.
This is also the guy, I should say in full disclosure, who decided for a while to walk around high school with a original Apple laptop that weighed about 35 pounds and had a 6-inch screen.
Oh, so he was just one of those guys.
He really liked old computers.
When laptops weren't really laptops, but more
they were
like
portable computers.
Like
they weren't
suitcases,
like quite laptops yet. Yeah.
All right, let's move on here. Apple released a Java update for OS X on Tuesday that is supposed to patch the vulnerabilities found in the previous Java version, which allowed malicious code to be executed just by visiting a compromised website. And that Java vulnerability claimed about 600,000 Macintoshes and made them essentially botnets, which is, I guess technically the biggest virus that has ever happened on the Mac OS.
Although I love how Apple fans were quick to point out, it's a flaw in Java. It's not a flaw in the Mac. The Mac is perfect. Except Apple's in charge of the security updates, you guys.
Right.
So it is sort of their fault.
I mean, this thing...
Well, it does ship with Java, doesn't it?
Yeah. And they control the updates because they don't... Like, on Windows, you have that crappy Java plugin that
always breaks when it tries to update.
So it's annoying, but then Apple took full control over that. And because of that, this is their responsibility to fix.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I feel like this is shitty, but I think we actually should expect a little bit more of this. And I say that because as Apple takes market share away from Windows for personal computers, the market for getting people's personal information via these Trojans and so on is going to go up. Like, there's an actual market for this information, a black market for people's information that is
wouldn't
is there.
The information
and that's what the hackers
for Mac users be worth a lot more, too?
Yes and no.
About
I mean,
the average Mac user.
Well, it depends. Like, if you're going to go, like... If the average Mac user, if by that you mean the average Mac user tends not to be so tech savvy, so they're more regular.
No, I mean they're wealthier, which is better.
I don't think you want to get
their data is
that
more expensive.
Yeah,
more...
I don't know if that's the case because those people.
If I were a smart pirate, people, that's what I'd do.
Yeah, wealthy people tend to have more controls over their personal data, meaning like your social security number, things like that. You'll get an alert. If you're wealthier, you're going to get an alert from your American Express card or whatever card more than you would from, you know, another card company that was made for a down market or whatever. You know what I mean? So at the same, like, I see kind of what you're saying in terms of you're hitting people with a bigger wallet, but people with bigger wallets tend to have more controls. The thing is, I think that Macintosh devices, Apple computers, I think that they're getting, they're finding a place for not rich people. I don't think you need to be rich to own a Mac anymore. I think that a lot of people are just regular, you know, muggle, not geek consumers are just sitting there and working on Macs and not really paying attention because they assume that Apple will take care of everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of where there's a market.
It was only a matter of time. I mean, I talked about this literally years ago on the on an earlier incarnation of the Drill Down with the former host co-host Mohammed Salim, the reason why the viruses are so prevalent on PC systems and not on Macintoshes was because of market share, because PCs had the majority of the market share. But now that Macs are eating up some of that market share, I mean, it can only be expected that the viruses are going to be bleeding.
And there's just less scrutiny. You know, like, people think, I got a Mac, I don't have to worry about it. Oh, this never happens on Macs, whatever. Like, you have on Windows machines, you have all sorts of – you have Sophos, you have McAfee, you have Symantec. You have all this crap running around trying to figure stuff out. None of these guys caught this thing, by the way. And you know what I mean? Like, I think there's just less scrutiny. So it was kind of like the – it's low-hanging fruit right now.
I disagree with that, actually. I think there's an old adage about security. Like, if you're talking about, like, some of those if you see something, say something campaigns in security, if you ask for amateurs to help you keep things secure, you're going to get amateur security, i.e. people, like, calling the cops on, like, you know, random guys with beards and not actual people with terrorists. And I think the same thing happens with, like, computer security. Like, yes, there are certain steps that people can and should take to ensure that their computers are up to date. But when it comes right down to it, like, it's the job of the manufacturers and the software, you know, distributors like Apple to ensure that the machine is secure. Like, having antivirus software, I think, is actually a false sense of security, because their success rate in preventing antiviruses is, like, I don't know, 50% or something. Even for some of the best that are out there, like, it's far better to just have patch systems, keep things up to date, and that's Apple's job.
But right. I see Wayne's point too, because, like, there is a certain sort of complacency with Mac users. It's like, it's sort of Apple's whole model, right? It just works,
right?
So you don't think
that's
about
kind of what I'm saying.
Security, you don't think about all these things. Whereas the PC, you're bombarded with all this crap. It's like, oh my god, my Windows updates. Oh my god, I have spyware. Spyware is something that Macs still don't really have. There are a few things that affect Macs, but on the whole, they're spyware. Like, and that to me, like, we've all worked in IT. It's like spyware is the big headache in PCs, and that's one thing Mac users really don't have to worry about. So in that respect, the Mac is at least.
And now there's all this stuff. Like a lot of these guys, Sophos looks at. They look at like spyware, malware, Trojans, true viruses, you know, like worms and so on. And then they also look at like, I don't know what this program is. Therefore, I think you should quarantine this program because I haven't seen it, which is something that kind of kills me because, and that's I think where the big difference is on a Mac. You know, you might have some tiny developer out of nowhere who just came out with a program, which you can go download and pay money for, and you'll kind of just trust that it'll work, whatever. It doesn't have like the download.com virus-free verified stamp on it, and that's
which is crap, by the way.
It's nonsense. It's absolutely nonsense. But people trust.
I talked with one of the high-level executives from CNET, which I think owns download.com, they go on and on about how much bullshit that security is. On that software. That's a whole nother thing. But yeah, I hear you, Dwayne. Although, if you try to open an executable that you download on your Mac, it'll tell you this file was downloaded from the internet. Are you sure you want to open it?
Yeah,
so you
that's
go through
right.
that. Mm-hmm. And the Mac App Store actually does offer the sort of security that, you know, the apps still have to be approved and all that stuff. Like when you get something from the Mac App Store, you have a certain sense that, okay, it's safe. And I haven't seen anything from the Mac App Store like have any major exploits or flaws at this point. So.
Apple. Enough about Apple.
No. Not yet.
Now bad Apple. Rotten Apple.
So speaking of, the U.S. sued Apple, Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin, and Simon & Schuster in New York District Court, claiming the publishers colluded to fix ebook prices. CBS, Simon & Schuster, Lagardère's Hachette Book Group and News Corp's HarperCollins settled their suits today. Apple and Macmillan, which have refused to engage in settlement talks with the Justice Department, denied that they colluded to raise prices for digital books. They will argue that pricing agreements between Apple and publishers enhanced competition in the ebook industry, which is dominated by Amazon Incorporated.
It wasn't collusion, guys. They were just secret meetings to drive up the prices of ebooks, so Amazon would have to raise their prices. What's wrong with that?
We just looked at what the RIAA did, and we thought, what's wrong with that? I mean, this is bothersome because it's more than like, okay, the virus thing, mistakes were made. Mm-hmm. But this, it shows a certain judgment that I think that, we have we've been looking at companies like Apple who have cornered the market in music and are like really eating away at telephone sales. They run tablet sales. They're really eating away at PC sales. And part of a company at that point, trust is really huge. And if this is what's coming out, I mean, the allegations, nothing's been proven yet, but trust is huge. And if you're going to corner a market, then you need to make sure that there is valid competition out there. Now, Amazon, there's all this press about Amazon, sort of like there's all this press about Apple when there was like a virus or something like that. But there's all this press about Amazon and how they're destroying publishing and how they're doing whatever. And the more you look at that, it's a conversation for another time, but the more you look at that, they may be actually taking out publishing, but they're not taking out writing and authors and like the source of the actual
content.
They brought
publishing to the digital age, I think. And
they brought publishing to the digital age, and publishing didn't want to change, and so publishing is beginning to fail. This, what we're seeing here is Apple went, and remember the iPad was supposed to save publishing? Part of the problem is publishing is the problem. Part of the problem is it's not like the artists, the writers do better, the booksellers do better if publishing gets out of the way. And I think that it's kind of weird to see Apple embrace an ancient paradigm that, whose time may have come in order to, try to get their foot in on this market. You know what I mean? It's sort of like Google and adding the social search results. Like, you don't do social, but you're going to add them to your results in order to, kind of buffer up your social.
This was like an interesting example, right, of Apple getting really, really desperate. Because they saw the Kindle taking off. They saw ebooks taking off outside of their control. So by the time they finally get an ebook playing
device. And
they're
the education company.
Yeah, exactly. And by the time they finally get a device that can actually, be sold as an ebook reader, they have to do whatever it takes. And this is like Steve Jobs' scorched earth policy when it comes to competition, how he wants to just destroy Android Whatever it takes, even if it's apparently breaking the law. And I know nothing was proven, but guys, just looking at the ebook market, like over those few years, like when all this went down, it was clear that Apple was just like, it was clear that through the
turning
store,
a blind eye in the face of like the law and fairness in order to get an advantage.
Right.
And that's
their enemy in this.
Working together to, you know, arrange prices, which I wish there was a word for that. I don't know what that is.
collusion?
Yeah.
Price fixing. Their enemy collusion. In this case was Amazon, and they were going to get rid of that enemy any way they could, and this is the way they were doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Amazon, I remember when the Kindle came out, all of us were like, it seems cool, but it's so expensive. And, you know, what the Kindle came out like maybe 2007. And the iPhone came out in maybe 2007 or whatever. And the iPad came out in 2010. And I feel like, you know, Apple had a lot of catching up to do because it was just like how the iPhone as a touchscreen phone device got into the culture as the symbol of this kind of device. You know, there are other ones made by other people. The Kindle became the symbol of the ebook, even though there are other devices, you know, other ebook readers made by other people. And, you know, I think they're being just totally right. Jobs and Co. were like, we have to crush these guys. You know, we deserve this. Yada, yada, yada. And I think that's kind of where things fell apart.
Yeah. And we're not really seeing the iBook store like taking off in terms of market share. I see some numbers like maybe 25%, which I think is really, that seems like really, I don't know, giving them a lot.
Inflated.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I think I bought one ebook on the Apple Store because I was doing a reading of Shakespeare with some people and I forgot to bring my Kindle.
It's the second Kindle.
That's weird.
It's like my backup. It's like, oh gosh, I forgot my Kindle.
But then
Kindle.
You bought that on Amazon, right? Did you buy that at the Kindle store or the iBook store?
No, you bought it in the...
I bought it in the iBook store because I didn't...
You could have gotten the Kindle app, you know?
There is a Kindle app. I don't believe that it allows you to actually buy things. Like, I know
they
shoot
you to the website, I think. Hold on, let me pull it up.
I think right. That's how they got around Apple's restriction of... in-store 30%. App purchases.
Yeah, so you could still go to the Kindle, the Amazon website, but, you know, it's
more
confusing.
Honestly, let's just say, is really unfortunate. I feel like that 30 cut is really, really, really harming, like, commerce on the mobile platform.
Uh-huh. Well, people have argued it really helped commerce on the mobile platform, right? Because it's not that big of a cut, and it's helped all sorts of app providers.
It's a pretty big cut.
Yeah, it depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you're selling hardware or something at razor-thin margins, there's no way that's going to work. If you're selling something at, you know, huge markup, you know, like ebooks or something, then yeah, I guess it kind of works. But, I mean, it really limits what people can do. I mean, yeah, certainly Android is definitely a far better place to do that sort of thing, but then you have all the problems of developing for the Android platform.
Yeah.
So there's just no good solution other than doing mobile websites, which I guess is good. I mean, it's nice to see that there's still some good value for the web.
All right, let's move on here. In Washington, D.C., New York, and other major cities, 40% of robberies involve cell phones. How can we reduce the number of mobile device thefts out there? The Federal Communications Commission thinks it has the answer. The FCC announced its Projects Initiative, which is a 3-point plan to fight cell phone theft. First, they'll be setting up a massive universal database, which will allow carriers to automatically disable any mobile devices, including both cell phones and wireless-enabled tablets reported stolen. The commission says that such a database will dramatically reduce stolen devices' value to would-be buyers. Mm-hmm. Second, the commission wants cell phone manufacturers to program devices to automatically prompt users to create passwords and take other steps to protect their data, which will make users somewhat more security conscious. And finally, a widespread public education plan will teach owners of mobile devices about the availability of mobile apps that allow users to remotely lock and delete the contents of stolen phones and tablets. And Apple, Motorola, Qualcomm, HTC, Microsoft, Nokia, and RIM are all on board with the FCC's plan.
Of course they are.
Awesome. Awesome.
Dude, if they know who owns what phone, and they know where that phone is at any given time, who's got it, whatever, they just, I don't know, like, it's probably a cultural thing because I'm an old man or whatever. But
I see your tinfoil hat on right now.
It's just too much. Like, it's too much.
What do you mean it's too much?
like there's too much information on that phone that's tied to an individual user to keep things safe. That's it's truly Big Brother at that point. You know what I mean?
Is that what you're worried about? You're not worried about, yeah, there's a ton of information on those phones, which people never unlock, and they never think about security when they have like all their data on it, right? And then people steal it, and that data is wide open. That's a real threat.
That is a threat, yes. I think that if we had a series of mandated policies, even if it was put into law, hey, cell phones need to like require this kind of password, they need to have, you know, X level of protection on them, yada, yada, yada. I would be down with that. If it was self-regulating industry, each company is siloed in the sandbox and it says, I have to have these programs in place if I'm going to sell a phone.
Right. The cell phone tracking was in place, like the real appeal to this, right, is that you have sort of this this something that ties you to your cell phone, and that opens up all sorts of problems. But would you really trust? So you would trust the companies, these cell companies that are literally trying to take our data and our money versus the government managing it.
I would. The reason why is because they know that, like, for instance, if Apple, Nokia, RIM, if one of them does something where they truly exploit our personal data for their own gain, and that gets out, then everyone leaves that company and goes to the one that says, hey, I didn't do that, and I promise not to. But with everyone running into the government, there's no place to go. There's no other place to go. Like, you run into a certain level of value versus short-term gain versus like long-term growth. When you have companies having to compete against one another to maintain services that are regulated, but not completely owned by a government, and that's the problem. I think there's no way to not look at that in that way. You see that basically, like, if the government has this information and there's no place for you to go in terms of you thinking that people are going to use it for whatever purposes, you're screwed. But if different companies have the information and one of them screws up, they're going to get hit by the government for screwing up on regulations, and people are going to go to some other companies. So they have incentives, true incentives, to not screw up. This, Congress is going to look at it in a couple of years and either say, we want to be able to leverage this information for law enforcement, we want to leverage this information for whatever, and there's going to be nothing. They already have that. They have pieces around it, but they don't really have that.
I think if what you're worried about is like the Big Brother scenario, we're already there, dude. Like, the things the NSA is building up, I'm not sure if you saw like Wired's crazy story about the NSA.
Oh yeah, that facility, which they're just
building facilities because they don't want to delete the data they collect from us. So they're just like, let's just keep building warehouses. Let's just keep putting servers in them. And that, like, to me, like, I have the assumption that the government already has a lot of our data, like especially this sort of thing. Like, this is just tying you to a cell phone. There's so many other pieces of data that I'm sure the NSA already has that ties you to your cell phone. Whereas the whole point of this program is really
right
what
now,
the SEC is all about,
needs,
though. Well,
right
well
now,
listen,
if I
listen,
do something
listen,
on my, if I do something on my AT&T cell phone and AT&T, and then the government says, hey, AT&T, we want to see this record. AT&T has a choice, and they can say, you know what? I'm going to alert my customer first, or I'm going to do whatever first, whatever. Okay. In this case, there's no such barrier. There's no such.
Let me finish, Swain, because it's like this is the FCC's job. Their job is regulation and, in a sense, consumer protection. And
FCC
it's
or
it's
FTC?
Only been it well, it's only been recently that we've really seen the organization kind of take it up when it comes to digital, right? Like they stopped the AT&T and T-Mobile merger because it was kind of clear that something was wrong with that. Like, that was not in the consumer interest. And this, I think, like, having like, the government take charge of this, this shows the importance of mobile, right? It's like it's like the difference between having, you know, public police officers versus having, you know, private police in your neighborhood. There are certain...
I fundamentally disagree. And I think the FTC is overstepping its bounds. I think Congress is going to stop this, hopefully. And I do think that it's the FTC's job, the Federal Trade Commission, to protect users. It's not the FCC's job. That's not what
you
they
mean
do.
They don't have to protect communication?
They have to protect communication, but they can protect wireless frequencies and so on. Their job isn't to look into what's best for when it comes to like theft and so on. That's not where they're at. They're not about the protection of the consumer. They're about protection of industries, spectrum, resources.
I think that's what the FTC is more about.
No.
There's too many E sounds
in
these words.
Yeah, go ahead.
The Federal Trade Commission and
Trade Commission focuses on protecting consumers you know, based on like X amount of threats in the marketplace and false advertising, yada, yada, yada. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC.
Yes.
Right. What they do is they protect the natural resources of the resources of radio, you know, in terms of like, communication, what our communication resources are. I think this is an overstep for them. I think that this is an FTC, a Federal Trade Commission issue, if it's an issue. It's not an FCC, a Federal Communications.
I think, Dwayne, like if the FTC did this, you would still have the same problem with it. So let me just say this. Like, the general idea here is having like a broad database that at least can track when cell phones are stolen. I think that how I don't understand how that's Big Brother, because initially this is only happening, you know, when a cell phone is reported stolen. Okay, so at that point you're kind of giving up the data on that cell phone anyway. You assume you're not getting it back. And like the idea to like just remotely kill those devices, I'd much rather have those things disabled rather than, you know, a thief being able to freely use it.
I'm not disagreeing with that as a regulation. I'm disagreeing with that as a government controlled policy, a government controlled action. I think these kind of regulations should be imposed on manufacturers and carriers where appropriate. But I don't think the government should handle that by itself.
So I'm not sure if I missed part of it. Is the proposal that the government would run this, or is the government going to mandate that this has to be the case and let the industry
run it?
The
government runs it. That's the problem. They don't if they were mandating it, I'd be cool. But they've run it. They're running it. There's a central government database-y thing. They run it, and that's what's wrong with it. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what's whack. They don't need to run this.
Well, even worse, Dwayne, the FCC has called upon all the carriers of the world, all the countries in the world, to join this database. Imagine what's going to happen then.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
Well, we'll wait till your cell phone is stolen, Dwayne, and then we'll see how you feel then.
I've never had a stolen cell phone, to be honest. It's interesting.
Anyway, my point is consumers are stupid, and I've talked about this before. We've already talked about how like nobody really cares about security, and their computers, in their phones, it's even worse. Like our smartphones have so much data. Our smartphones, like, they have all, you know, access to our email, and so few people lock their devices in any way. And that's sort of the bigger problem. It's not like that idea that this is a computer, guys. Like, this has your data. This can do all sorts of stuff. It's not just a phone. You should probably protect it somehow.
You're telling me if it was mandated that people had to have codes or whatever, and it was mandated that there had to be a way for the device carrier to check, you know, find my iPhone kind of thing for all phones or whatever, you wouldn't think that that's appropriate? You think that the government should control all of that?
I did not say that, Dwayne.
That's what I'm saying. That's my argument here. I think that these things –
just created a false scenario and you put it in my mouth. So that's
– I didn't. I'm asking – that was a question I'm asking. I didn't say that that's what you think.
No, you said you think I'm that like, and then
yeah,
you inserted
this. Yeah, but it was in the question tone.
Thing.
I wasn't putting the words in your mouth. Bottom line is I'm asking if you think that it's better for – that to be something that, you know, the Find My iPhone scenario, the universe, the wipe scenario, all those things. If AT&T or Apple or whomever was forced by law to be in charge of those things rather than the government running those things, would you be anathema to that? Would that be a turnoff for you? Would that be something that you're like,
no, because that's how it already works. Like, a Find My iPhone is run through Apple because it's Apple's operating system, and the same thing with Android. Like, at that point, you know, the software companies and, you know, even certain Android manufacturers have their own versions of, like, finding stolen devices. So, like, at that point, it makes sense. Like, I'm just saying it's good to have a blacklist database for when phones get stolen. That's all this is on the FCC side.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right. I think it'll grow. Shall we move on?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. Microsoft has agreed to pay AOL $1.056 billion to acquire 800 patents and gain license to the rest of the patents AOL will continue to own after the pending sale.
Wait, was that 1.56?
1.056.
Okay, sorry, I heard 1.056. I was waiting.
Basically a billion dollars.
Yeah, billion dollars. They'll gain non-exclusive licenses to the remaining 300 or so patents that AOL keep. Another component of the sale involving transfer of stock in an unspecified AOL subsidiary just happens to be the AOL-owned Netscape. So Microsoft will buy the underlying patents for the old browser, but AOL will hang on to the brand and the related Netscape businesses. So $1 billion for 800 patents, and a lot of them having to deal with browser issues with the Netscape stuff. I don't know. I mean, I just feel like this is overkill. That we are, you know, we're well past mutually assured destruction.
Hey man, didn't Google buy Motorola for $12.5 billion and they have no clue what to do with it? And
no, that thing is for the patents.
But, the problem is mm-hmm. as we're seeing though, like mutually assured destruction is not working.
Right, it's not working.
Yahoo
not
is suing Facebook. In the mobile space, people are beginning to sue each other. Like the hope was, if the big companies kept big enough patent portfolios, they would all realize they'd be mutually assured. It in the past like year or so, I think probably starting with Apple's lawsuit against HTC, we started to see that break down. Yeah, so we started to see that break down. We started to see the big companies start to embroil in these huge, huge patent lawsuits. And so now everyone's going after these giant patent portfolios looking for basically more arms to defend themselves because they know that it's actually likely that some dying technology company like AOL or like Yahoo or like, you know, whatever the next dying technology company becomes, you know, is going to start suing people in desperation.
It's not like I think mutual assured destruction is not really the right paradigm to think of it. We think of, like that. What that really means, it has to do with like the way that the governments tried to avoid World War III by having these big things that could destroy the whole situation. The patent system or the world is not in any kind of threat here. This is not mutually assured destruction. The companies may get hurt here and there and everywhere, but they're still going to be around. Given these lawsuits, these lawsuits aren't going to bankrupt any particular company. I think what we're looking at here is more of a, you know, Apple's opening salvo against HTC, and everything that precipitated after that, the whole like kind of weird diagrams that we've seen. It's very World War I. Everyone has alliances. Everyone has weapons and arms, and everyone's going after one another. I think what we're seeing here with Microsoft buying these patents is, and Google buying those other patents is akin to just like I need more fuel for the fire. They believe that their risk says that, you know, Google, I'm like $200 billion company. I'm going to spend like 12 of that billion on hardware, and I'm also going to get a whole bunch of patents for it. And Microsoft is like, I'm going to get a whole bunch of patents from McAfee. I'm going to get a whole bunch of patents from AOL for less money than I get for a pretty small amount of money. And I'm going to be able to not only defend myself, but Microsoft has actually actively chased down people. They're making hundreds of millions of dollars a year on Android. So Microsoft, this is a profit center for Microsoft. You know, like Windows Phone is heavily subsidized, theoretically, by, you know, Android device sales. So this is like not just a question of like, I'm going to hold on to this in case I get sued by somebody. This is, I use my patent portfolio actively. I use it aggressively, and I use it to get what I want from other companies.
Like I view this whole patent war, it's like imagine there's a giant beach, right? And all these tech companies are building sand castles. And at this point, the patents are like, you know, the more patents you have, the better your sandcastle. So somebody can't
the
just come by and
get.
Like kick it down. Yeah, the more sand you get, like you can make better walls and moats or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like
you
can
also
a nice
make sand
structure.
Cannons if you're Microsoft.
Exactly. You know? Well, you can do that sort of thing cannons. Too. Yeah. But I don't know. It's like Microsoft has been very active in how they do this, but they haven't really done the patent warfare that we're seeing from some of the other companies. They're just saying like, hey guys, license our shit. And most of the companies
It was patent warfare. The thing is, they went after HTC. They went after the other company. They went after HTC as an example, and they settled out of court. Many of these other things, when we talk about the patent war, I think most of us are thinking of the court cases that are going on. Microsoft just happened to say, look, I'm so big. And court really, like the law is really not necessarily about truth. It's about who's got more power at the time. They're like, I'm so big, you really can't even afford to go up against me. And they were like, okay, you got me. I'm culpable. Whatever. I'll pay you some money as long as I can be profitable. And Microsoft's like, sure, whatever. So they've been, I think, the most successful at being aggressive. They've just been smart enough not to keep it in court.
Yeah, but I mean, I still feel like there is a loss here for everyone. Like, yes, the big companies are probably not going to shut each other down over this. That's not likely. However, we are seeing $1 billion being spent on nothing. Like, seriously, like nothing. Yeah. It's already been invented. The technology is already being used. There's no additional thing that's being gained to anyone in the general to this. And the more billions that are spent on these things, the more money that's not spent on R&D, it's not spent on investment, it's not spent on salaries, it's not spent on anything that does any actual like economic good to the industry or any surrounding industries.
I agree with that.
And there's also the additional fact that like there are a number of companies that could and probably we will see at some point, you know, be shut down by patent lawsuits, because the little guys, the guys who have like a Series A of a few million dollars, they don't have money to fight this. Yeah. They don't have money at all, and they are a threat to, especially like, I'm not thinking like Microsoft. Yeah, but even the licensing terms, like, you know, you may not be able to afford the licensing terms. Or if your product is an existential threat rather than just simply a, like, something you can get, you just simply might not do a licensing terms. Like, it's always up to the patent holder to say, like, oh, you know what? We're just simply not going to give you a licensing to this because we think that your business model is too dangerous for us.
The economic – well, I think you're not looking at it economically. But I showed up with a great new disruptive technology, and it leaned on – certain patents that I had listed as prior art, and Microsoft was like, well, you've got to license these patents. There's a deal to be struck there. If my technology is so disruptive, Microsoft wouldn't just shut it down. They'd probably purchase it. And that purchasing it is going to free me up to either work on their – like if you can't beat them, join them. That's economics. Either free me up to work with them or give me the kind of capital I need to start something different. But either way, I mean, I'm not saying this is a perfect situation. I'm not like defending all this stuff, but I am saying that I think that it's not really destroying the lives of small software and other manufacturers right now. I don't see it destroying those lives yet. And if there is data that shows that, then I'll look into that and I'll speak to that. But from what I've seen and what I've looked at, I just haven't seen that reality coming to pass just yet.
Why would a small startup want to invent anything if some big company can prove that they've got prior art?
Because then you can sell it. A lot of companies that are small, they exist so that they get picked up by big companies that are in that vertical or touch that vertical. You know, Instagram, YouTube, whatever. That's the dream. But that's where all the like small tech companies, they want to be picked up by big tech companies. That's kind of how it works.
I'm posting a link, Dwayne, by the way, that actually does prove that.
What?
Posting a link that actually does show that patent trolling hinders innovation.
Hot. Good to see. I think there's another issue going on here, like that if it was simply the case that patents were simply there were a lot of them, it was very expensive and people were suing each other, I don't think I would consider this as much of a problem. Mm-hmm. I think part of the thing that really pisses off an awful lot of engineers and other sort of tech observers is that like when we talk about these patents, we're not talking about actual innovations. We're talking about like mostly bullshit patents. Like, yeah. There are engineers who have patents. Like there was that article in NPR a while back on patents. And, you know, engineers were like, yeah, I looked at the patents that are in my name and I couldn't tell you what in the world is going on in them. And I theoretically invented it. And on top of it, you have things like, you know, patents for basic CS concepts that you learn in CS 101. And sure, there's prior art, but do you have money to spend to pay, lawyers $1,000 an hour to go through it when they have lawyers to spend thousands of dollars an hour fighting against it? Like the price adds up so quickly that like it just ends up being a form of blackmail. Like, and that's really what it gets down to. I mean, like this is we're complaining about like anti-competitive behaviors when it comes to book manufacturers and collusion when it comes to book manufacturers. I mean, this is anti-competitive behavior. This is companies using their size to prevent other companies from doing things which are perfectly legal just simply because they're
large. Let me ask you this, Chris. Microsoft Apple's OS OS comes out. It's using a mouse. It has like a little Windows whatever. Several years later, Microsoft comes out with Windows 95, which is clearly a blatant ripoff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if Apple had the capital, if Apple had the whatever, do you think that they shouldn't say, this is a blatant ripoff, this is a problem? When you look at Android, and you look at sort of what Android is being put out there, and I'm not talking about slides unlocked, but this fundamental paradigm of, kinetic scrolling and, all these pinch to zoom, multi-touch technologies, these things that Android clearly looked at the Apple phone, copied several aspects of the Apple phone from its original design parameters, which was a copy of the BlackBerry.
do you think that this copycat technology completely exists, needs to exist? Do you think that this, I mean, I'm not gonna deny that Android has dragged iOS kicking and screaming into the modern day when it comes to certain features. That said, is it, when you look at the Samsung stuff, for instance, where Samsung has copied Apple's look, the feel, the shape, all that other stuff like that, do you really think that there's nothing there, that there's no there there?
I mean,
I do,
that's
honestly.
The whole industry. Though,
I mean, that's how every aspect of CS works. I mean, every computer language is built on previous ones. Every like programming concept is built on previous ideas. Like, people don't just come
There's
out
a difference
and like
building on previous ideas. For instance, MySpace built on Friendster, but it was a completely different animal. Facebook built on ideas that were in MySpace, but again, a completely different animal. There's a difference there. Than saying,
wait, in what way is Windows not also a completely different animal from OS 7?
Yeah,
like I mean, they're both graphical user interfaces.
The paradigm was clearly copied in a way that didn't. I don't know. I feel like they didn't. The differentiation isn't that apparent to me.
I guess OS 10 wasn't that different from what Xerox PARC was working on either. It's
well,
like
right. Apple
everyone's
the
stealing
right.
ideas.
No, that will stop. There was no stealing with Xerox PARC. Apple
There's also an that. Additional problem that happens.
Money. Like I got to put that out there. People will say Apple Xerox. Apple bought that. When it comes to what Microsoft did, they didn't buy it from Xerox. They didn't license it from Xerox. They didn't license it from Apple. Now, do I like Microsoft products? Sure. Do they allow, you know, is there like a larger sphere of applications for Microsoft? Their Windows operating system from then for Mac OS X operating system, that might even be the same. It's the same for Android and iPhone, but that doesn't mean that they're just taking it for the sake of taking it and running with it and not fundamentally changing the paradigm in some way. So your closed window thing is on the left side instead of the right side. You use a Command W instead of an Alt F4. You know, like those aren't material differences. They're in some ways they're just clones, and that's what I'm talking about. There's a difference. Between, I think that to dismiss the whole thing throws out innovation in and of itself. You look at what Dell's doing with their computers right now. They simply took Apple's unibody design and they've managed that with plastic and metal in terms to have like Apple type clone devices. And
you know, I think they're not
spending money on innovation. They're spending money on copying. And I think that what there's you might say we're talking about different things. I don't know. What I'm saying is I think there's definitely space where copying has happened that was unfair. I'm not going to defend every single patent suit out there. I'm not going to defend whatever. But I think that there's the hard lines on either side are bothersome for me because there's a reason to have a patent system, and there's a way that it's being abused, and I agree it's being abused in many ways. But I also think that people's intellectual property has been stolen in many ways, and I think that happens a lot. That's happened with – when it comes to the design of Android, when it comes to what Samsung has done, I think it's very, very clear. The trade dress, the trade marks, the patents, all these things, like stealing, contrary to Steve Jobs' words, stealing isn't okay no matter who you are.
So, you know? So two points about that. First of all, there was a study, and I'll put the link up when I can find it. I think it was on Ars Technica, actually, on the numbers problem with patents, especially in software patents. There are so many software patents and it is so unbelievably easy to get a software patent that there are literally not enough lawyers in the world to audit every single system before it goes to market to ensure that it doesn't infringe on somebody's
patent. And the patent office doesn't know.
And even if you hired a lawyer to do it, like there's just literally not enough manpower to do the sort of – like if you really want to like be like, OK, I want to make sure that I'm bringing something to market that literally no one has a patent on, it's mathematically impossible to do that because it literally is not enough time or even lawyers to hire.
The fact is that you're supposed to be able to build on the success of others, but you're supposed to be able to reference and license in order to do that. That's where the difference is. I think that's where the divide is here. Like the whole point of patents is so that when you the Stradivarius case, Stradivarius dies, no one knows how to make a Stradivarius. We'll lose those violins when they're finally done. The idea of a patent is a Stradivarius had patented his violin. We would have the secrets out there for people to use, for people to build on top of, for people to make sense of. And
yeah, but
so that
part
there's
of-
a, That's a, that. All I'm saying is that there's the what you're talking about is where the abusive patents does come in, but at the same time, there's, you know, in terms of like the whole trolling thing. But at the same time, there is if you're just gonna copy something that's already in the marketplace to make a quick buck, that's problematic too.
See, I feel like that's what the marketplace is about. The marketplace is about people finding, like, you know, ideas and going to them. I mean, like, does Groupon have, you know, a monopoly on the idea of selling coupons? I mean, like, copying is part of the business marketplace and always has been. And I guess one thing I object to in some, most of the examples that, you know, that you gave, those are mostly design and creative elements to things. And as such, I don't think that they're actually what the patent was office or system was, right. was designed for. It's designed
Apple
for technological innovation.
Mouse operating system. Apple purchased the patents for mouse operating systems from Xerox Spark. Xerox Spark had that. They had that. They had that unlocked. They designed it. They wrote the software for it. They created the paradigm. They created the process patents and everything around it. And Apple said, I want that. I can do something better than what they did with that. And they're sitting on it. I'm going to buy it from them. I'm going to take it. I'm going to run with it. I'm going to make something wonderful. It's not about design elements. I mean, that's there, sure. But that's – this is you have
but
to
the,
think
the
about
Microsoft
what
one,
is
exactly what you're talking about. I mean, they – that was a I mean, they're copying
so
design
I said that,
same with Android.
I just – Well, I just said that Apple purchased the rights to do this.
No, but Dwayne, don't rewrite history here. Like, the way that I've been reading this whole situation is that, you know, Jobs went to Xerox PARC. He was wowed by the mouse and the GUI operating system. And at that point, he immediately started working on, like, ways to implement it. How long after did they patent it? Like, or did they license the patents? Do you know?
I don't. I think
I don't
like,
actually know. I was looking it up. Like, my understanding
I
is that
don't
they let him see it.
Yeah. No, it was clear. Like, he kind of knew this is a thing. He had to do it no matter what it took, really. And I'm not sure about the patent licensing on that. But, you know, it's clear that, you know, he and Microsoft were kind of doing the same race at that point. So I don't know. Like, I don't see how you can call that one any different than, you know, Android.
Well, look, in the end, you look at the person who actually gave them their due for that stuff, and it was Apple. What I'm saying here is that there clearly is a problem with the system. And I think that we need to look at that problem. But I don't think the thing is to throw it out. And I do think that there's also a problem with people not recognizing that taking certain concepts and just, you know, like blatant, like not adding anything to them, copying them in the marketplace or just kind of like, you know, not quite rolling with them to stand on the shoulders of them, but just to kind of like run and do the copycat thing, the knockoff thing, the lack of a remix, that is also a problem that has to be dealt with. You know, like that's
see,
a good thing.
I think
right there
are rules. I think there are systems for dealing with that. There is, you know, a great deal of intellectual property. There are trademark laws. There are, and I think probably this is from a strategic point of view. This is probably the best strategy is trade secrets law. There is a, you know, a great deal of law there to protect companies, to allow them to protect their trade secrets, like Coca-Cola. I mean, that's a food product. It's not patentable. But there's a great deal of, you know, legal precedent out there to enable Coca-Cola to keep their recipe secret. And that ends up being what most companies do anyway, because the patent system fails to protect the little guys. And it doesn't have, you know, the same costs associated with it. And I don't know. It's far more effective, and it doesn't have these sort of, you know, huge, you know, damages and everything that can come into it. I mean, that's one of the problems you have with patent law is that, you know, if even a single tiny part of a, you know, a lawsuit ends up being proven, then the entire device can be blocked, and that's, you know, extremely the probability that, you know, some part of your, you know, computer, which has, you know, thousands and thousands of parts, is infringing on something somewhere is extremely likely.
Right.
I don't disagree with that. Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with that. It's clear that I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm disagreeing with the idea that, like, if you take someone's shit, you copy it wholly, and then you run with it. That you should be relatively accountable. That's all I'm saying.
Well, Dwayne, actually, let me, because I knew your interpretation of history sounded fishy to me. So I've been looking it up as you've been talking on and on. So the way that went down was that Xerox was able to buy pre-IPO stock from Apple. Apple never licensed the GUI engine or anything from Xerox PARC. And in exchange for that stock, Apple, like Steve Jobs, was able to take a tour and see what Xerox PARC was working on. At that point, he saw, like, the mouse and the GUI stuff after really pushing them to show them, like, their coolest shit. And he, at that point, he went on and then he started developing what the Mac would be in the Mac GUI. So when Apple, you know, Apple eventually accused Microsoft of violating copyright, Xerox went back and sued Apple in a similar way. But apparently that lawsuit was dismissed. So I'm just saying, like, what
it
Apple
was
did
dismissed
was
because Apple it was dismissed because Apple went and they went and licensed from Park. That's why it was dismissed. It's like
no,
well, it's like
no.
That's from what I, that's part of what I
okay.
what I read.
Okay.
As
well, that's not true. It was dismissed for other reasons that I'm reading here. But I'm just saying, Apple in terms of the actual what you're presenting, this case where Apple is a little holier than you know other companies in this case, it's clear that even Apple can do this. And this is like
they're not perfect. There were examples. What I'm saying is, like what I'm saying is the bottom line is that they went, they paid a fee, they took a look, they did what they had to do.
That was not part of the agreement of the fee. So anyway, I don't want to nitpick here. I'm just saying you're forcefully giving us a new version of history.
It's clear we're not going to solve the software patent issue here tonight. It's an ongoing thing, and then we're just it's just indicative of the entire issue. This getting back to Microsoft's purchase of the AOL patent portfolio.
Yeah.
Let's move on here. Dwayne, you wanted to talk briefly about the Nokia Lumia 900 launch.
Yeah, this is a pretty strange launch. Basically, Nokia, European company, biggest cell phone maker in the world, sets out to go ahead and say, you know, we've got this new phone, Microsoft's behind us, we've got all this money, we're going to throw it out there, and we're going to launch this phone. So they go out and they launch the phone on Easter Sunday, where none of the AT&T stores are open. It's exclusive to AT&T.
Yeah.
And so most of the original sales are pre-sales, sure. Amazon goes out and claims it's the number one selling device that it's got that it has. It's in terms of its mobile phones, like the number one selling phone on Amazon. They mention the Droid Razr Max and the Galaxy Nexus and how mm-hmm. it's beating those devices. It just kind of all sounds relatively fishy, especially because we all know that as Amazon will claim that you know the Kindle is their best selling device, and they won't tell us what the numbers are for the sales. Whereas other people tell numbers, it was just a very interesting job. Wanted to know what you guys thought about it. Also, after all this hullabaloo, and the phone ended up coming out on, it was supposed to come out in like the middle of March. It came out, you know, on Easter instead in April. There, Nokia found a glitch and had to like replace several of the devices, giving people credits.
Well, the device is effectively free if you buy it up until I think it's April 21st. Anybody who buys the 900 can just apply and get this $100 credit. So if you've been waiting, you know, for one, I'd say just go do it because it looks like this can be fixed with a firmware thing. Nokia says they have that coming out, but it's a shame. Like, there's a lot of great stuff about that device. I really liked it. I reviewed it. Basically, that review went up before the last episode of the Drill Down, but I wasn't here for that one. It's a great phone. Like, for me, it is the best $100 cell phone, or at least a phone actually released at $100 that mm-hmm. I've ever used. The iPhone 4, the 8-gig version, is $100 now. So that's kind of the only big competition for it. But, you know, it's LTE. It has a nice big screen. It's great. And then they launch on Easter Sunday for some godforsaken reason.
I think I know why they launched Easter Sunday, though. I'm pretty sure I know.
Even though so many stores were closed?
Exactly, because I think they launched Easter Sunday because if you have a big, huge launch with the Times Square thing and Nicki Minaj mm-hmm. and all this other stuff like that, do you want the tech press scrutiny? Like, why? Well, there were no lines for this. This wasn't a big launch. Like, this is supposed to be a big deal, whatever. You launch it focusing on pre-sales, and you know, you say that, you know, that this many people committed to it and all this other mm-hmm. stuff, and Amazon comes out and says it's the best-selling phone on their site and everything.
Right.
You don't have to worry about the joke that we constantly see with the line, like, you know, whether it's Samsung making fun of Apple, the lines around it, or everyone making fun of, like, you know, Google when there are no lines around it.
Well, they would have been screwed either way. Like, if they had launched on a normal day, they would have compared the lines to the iPhone. But honestly, now, though, like, I think that's much less of a problem than literally choosing a day when many of your stores are closed. Like, that just seems like
it was the only choice, though, because they're writing – this isn't just like a – like, yeah, Apple makes most of its money off the iPhone. Yeah, Motorola is making most of its money off of their Droid devices, that kind of thing.
Was their only choice to launch this on Sunday?
What I'm saying is if they can't sell this device, they're done. they're done.
That doesn't disagree with what I'm saying, though. You're saying that was their only choice. Like, it would not have been that tough to bump up, like, either move forward this launch or make this launch not on freaking Easter. Like, there are many other days in the year, guys. Like, there's a Friday. You can pick any Friday. Any Friday,
I mean,
really.
I don't know what their thinking was, but I don't know what their thinking was. I'm not privy to that, whatever. I'm just saying that they managed, their PR people, whoever said we're going to push this launch back, they managed to launch it on a day where there's no real news anyway on Easter. So they got all the attention.
They didn't get much attention, though.
If you're like any kind of tourist in New York on Easter, and you're rolling by Times Square, suddenly, like, Nicki Minaj is out there, there's a whole bunch of crowds, there's all this stuff. The attention is focused on that event and not on how the phone is selling. The attention is focused on the big superstar and the fireworks and the hullabaloo and not on the typical, like, the lines. They made it a media thing. They didn't make it a – they kind of just walked around the situation. I'm not saying it was the right
move. I think we have philosophical differences with how they approach this. The bigger problem is that freaking software bug, which to me is a sign that, you know, geez, like the very first day you have this thing out there, like pretty much the day after it's launched, you have to have like a pretty major software update and a freaking major rebate program too for this. And how much is that going to cost Nokia? I know Microsoft is literally throwing money at this project to make sure it succeeds.
That's why they were able to do this.
Yeah, it's kind of a problem. That's a big problem. One thing I have seen, though, is some of the new TV commercials, which has Chris Parnell, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Those were great. Those were actually good. Great to see a good cell phone commercial from Microsoft for now. So hoping those actually have some sort of influence.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly see why they're bending over backwards to get this to work, because they have to get it to work.
They have to. There is no choice.
That's a big part of what I'm saying. And that's the thing, that this is also strange, that the phone was delayed for half a month and it still had this glitch. I mean, that's weird.
But, I think they could do it. If you look at the history of the Xbox and how much money they lost on that, and now it's, its adoption is firmly seated, so...
We've made this argument before. What I think is really great about the Lumia 900 and to a lesser extent the 800 is that it is completely different, right? This is a device that you look at it, you feel it in your hand. It looks unlike anything you've ever seen. So, an Android cell phone, you can sort of sometimes mistake for an iPhone or something else. Android smartphones in general have like a general sense of like not very striking or daring design. They're, screens, and maybe some of them are thinner than others. Who knows what? Mostly plastic. It feels weak in your hands. But you hold the Lumia 900, and it feels like a substantial piece of electronics. And there's that, it hits that emotional connection with the consumer that I think a lot of people, that's why I still stick with the iPhone, because it's, for me, a better device when I hold it. It's something that, makes me feel a little better when I use it. I feel a little more confident in its abilities versus the cheap, plasticky Android crap. So it's good for Microsoft to have a flagship phone like this for once.
Yeah. All right, let's move on here. Netflix has formed a political action committee called FlixPAC. And some people had speculated that they had formed this to promote pro-SOPA agenda, and frankly, I don't know. I'm not even really sure why they have formed this FlixPAC. What their intention is of what they
although
hope
we know
to promote.
It's not for SOPA,
right?
Yeah.
So
how do we know that? Just out of curiosity,
Netflix said it wasn't.
Oh.
They're like,
oh, well,
no,
in that case.
No, all your worries. Don't worry about it.
So I'm safe from terrorists because the government tells me so, but, and they're not spying on me because they tell me so, too?
So what do you think their intentions are with this pack?
You know, I think a lot of Silicon Valley and the tech industry in general, but, sort of as symbolized by Silicon Valley, realized this past year that we need to have a voice in Washington too. And that, in the absence of, building up huge, insider industry, I don't know exactly what all the terms are for what goes on in Washington, but you know what I mean? Like the stuff that Hollywood has been doing for the last 30 years, instead of doing that, I guess they're saying, well, political action committees are going to be faster, get some stuff out there. And let's, you know, I don't know. That's my theory. I don't think they even necessarily themselves have a specific, like, goal other than the preservation of their interests.
Netflix have a plan?
Hmm. Well, you know, in a way it makes sense because Hollywood has had their own, you know, lobbyists in Washington for decades now, and Netflix is by extension they're becoming the new Hollywood, and other services like Netflix as well. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense.
I just feel like Netflix gets its fingers in a lot of things they don't necessarily like. We saw like Netflix not having a plan earlier this year, et cetera.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. Like Netflix having a plan, I don't know. Like they might be into this. This might be like a thing. It's kind of like it's just we need more information to really know what's going on here.
Well, let me just make this clear because the whole confusion was initially when this got reported was that Netflix was supporting a pro SOPA, you know, super PAC, and that does not make sense, guys. Like there is no reason to think that Netflix would do this. They denied it, and you look at the history of the company. Like they've never outright supported SOPA. Because their very existence relies on the tech-savvy influencers, as Andy likes to call them, who listen to our show and who browse the internet and read tech blogs every day. So why the hell would Netflix do that? It doesn't.
They're
make
very
any sense.
Liberal when it comes to the net. Obviously they're very anti net neutrality. They're very focused on net neutrality. They don't think that things should be able to be taken down immediately. Whatever. I think that Devinger has a pretty good point there. But I just feel like. We just won't know until we see action because Netflix they've said things in the past, they reneged on, they said things in the past or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're just not very clear when it comes to their PR engine right now. So
it doesn't
unreliable
make any sense.
Though.
Like SOPA would in no way help Netflix's interests. So this is one of those
unless the Netflix
where you just kind
of should be the only place to get streaming video. I guess. That's a stretch.
This is one of those instances where it's kind of useful to use your own reasoning. And your own judgment, right. And look at it when a news site is taking blowing something out of proportion. That's
don't
really
Devinder, wait! I'm used to people telling me what to think. I'm confused.
I know. It's tough.
I'm not sure if I should believe
okay,
you.
Guys. It's okay.
All right. One final headline here before we launch into our major story here, and that is Google gave its flagship social network Google Plus a makeover today. Unveiling a major redesign of the service. The new design is much prettier and easier to navigate than its predecessor. It presents a neat stack of icons that sit off to the left of the screen, allowing people to jump quickly to different areas of Google+, including Hangouts, group video chat, photos, circles, and games. Have you guys gotten a chance to take a look at Google's Google+ makeover?
Yep.
Looks nice. Yeah, I've seen it.
Looks a little too much like the Facebook timeline, but it looks
it
nice.
It kind of does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All the same elements are in all the same parts of the screen. Like the chat is, you know, off to the right. And I think it's – I like the new navigation. And what I like about it in particular is that Hangouts kind of has its own new separate category now.
Yeah.
And you click on it and you can find Hangouts that are emerging, which I wasn't able to do. It may have been there all along, but I have never been able to do it.
No. But finding Hangouts before, like they were hidden in your stream,
yeah.
It was really confusing how to invite people and if you wanted to create a private Hangout and what the fuck is going on. It seems, I don't know, like it got a little friendlier. And finally, like they figured out a way to promote the best feature of Google Plus. Like, it only took them... When did Google Plus launch?
Right.
Like,
last
August?
Summer.
Yeah, last summer.
September, August. Isn't
it? I'm a little fed up, guys. Like, I'm a little fed up with Google launching stuff that it can't succeed. Like, everything is a beta for this company, and we've known that for a while. But now it feels like literally everything
well,
is a beta.
Actually,
like,
you didn't sound off on this, but how did you feel about the goggles, the glasses?
No, well, that's completely... That's a little different, but I'll talk about that. But they can't really... And that has problems of its own. It seems like Google can't form a complete thought without throwing a half-assed idea out there, waiting for the feedback, and then trying to fix it. So that's a very engineered approach. Like, that's how engineers think. Like, they want the feedback. They want to iterate and slowly perfect this thing. But when you're producing products for the public and you're one of the biggest freaking companies in the world, you kind of have to build things that work. So with the Google Glasses thing, like, that's... I'm fine with concept ideas. Like, I can understand why... a concept idea wouldn't initially work, like the self-driving cars. That's something that's far off. They're working on this. It's cool. I feel it's great. But even the Google Glass project had its own problems. Like, they gave us that video that gave us – did you guys talk about it last week?
Yeah.
For
me, they gave us a video, a version of the future that I don't want to live in. You know, it's this world where literally everything you're doing is powered by consumption. Like, you're going to get a coffee. You're going to take a picture. Like, you're doing stuff. You're not actually living in a way. Mm-hmm, and I don't know. Like, it seems like the worst possible way to sell something that where people are already worried about technology taking over your life.
The only thing I say about the glasses, like, versus the car, I think the car is a great idea. I like the fact that there's a beta of the car. And they started talking about the car once the car was in, like, alpha or whatever stage it was in. There was something there to look at. There was something there to see. There was something there to understand that there are going to be iterations of. Like that Microsoft video from a long time ago, I didn't like the fact that this was clearly kind of sci-fi out there, a vision that, you know, is whatever. If they had some sort of, like, glasses-based interface, no matter how bulky, big, helmet-like, whatever, that we could take a look at and be like, oh, and then they can lean on it and say, I see where this is going, yada, yada. And we could say, oh, I see where they could take this. I have my imaginations now sparked. I can do whatever. Instead of seeing this completely weird, polished thing, I was a little upset about that. And I think that, for me, the big thing with what Google's done is that they used to focus on search. And after that, they kind of focused on email. And they got those things very, very good.
Well, let's not forget about advertising.
They focused on search in order to get the advertising right. If they can bring the customer to you, if they can focus on the search correctly and get that product done right, then the customer will come and the advertisers will follow. With the email, they've kind of tried it, whatever, but at least they got the email right. They focused on the email, the way the threading happens, the labels, very powerful stuff. And that also brings advertisers. Is it as effective as a search? Probably not, but it still brings advertisers. And I feel like what we've seen is that they've kind of – their fingers have been in so many different projects that we haven't seen that focus. And I think that's kind of where Google has been kind of – we've gotten away from the core Google. There's less focus. Now I guess they're focusing on Plus, bringing everything together, focusing on Plus as this portal for everything that they have. I just feel like for whatever reason, it doesn't feel like the same organic focus, the same kind of natural focus that we were excited about in years past from Google.
Yeah, I think that was the advice Steve Jobs gave Larry Page to, like, when they had a meeting, I think when he took over the CEO role again. I remember reading in the book that one of the things Jobs said was that you guys are in danger of becoming Microsoft. And now we're seeing this happen before our eyes, and it's kind of scary and kind of sad.
Yeah, I think, Dwayne, like, you sort of criticized Google for the problems with both the goggles and Plus. I feel like Google has a very – I have this theory that companies out there have, like, a department within the company that, like, basically runs the company. Like, in Apple, like, design is everything. In Google, engineering is everything. In Zynga, the product division is everything. Oracle, like, sales is everything. I feel like, you know, Google's problem is they don't understand product. They're getting way better at design, but they're not understanding that a product is more than just good engineering combined with a pretty design. And I feel like that's Plus's problem. It's just like a bunch of features, like the ones that Facebook have, arranged kind of like Facebook, in a slightly different order.
And they're like,
it's good, it's pretty, right? They don't understand, like, the product, you know, has to have a reason why. Like, why do people use this?
Right.
Why do people want to come this? Why do people want to use, you know, Google goggles? Like, and how do people interact with it? I mean, I think goggles' problem is they're just sort of like, well, wouldn't this be cool? And that's great, but you know, with that video,
you're touching on exactly what I'm feeling.
Yeah, they don't understand that why behind a product, and they don't understand, like, what draws people in, you know, to get them to do something. It's not just a matter of being well engineered and pretty.
It's got to have a reason for being. It's got to solve in some ways a problem or give people some sort of, like, God, I hate this word, but some sort of killer thing that you kind of can't live without, even if it doesn't solve a problem for you. You know what I mean? But I feel like that's that's kind
of this is where we see, like, Steve Jobs' love of Japanese culture, right?
The idea
of, like, you know, how somebody can spend their entire life becoming the best, like, sushi maker, the best noodle maker, the best at something. And that's sort of what Apple has pursued. Like, they have all sorts of different products, but they do try to be the best at what all those things are. I don't know. Like, Google is fundamentally, like, they're chasing Facebook as a competitor.
Mm-hmm.
When honestly, it doesn't make sense to be chasing them when Google has so much more to offer, and they should be more focused on giving us what's next.
Well, they should be focused on their core mission. Their mission was to organize the world's information. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand how this – I feel like they've been sort of – I think there's a danger that happens in the Valley, and I think with a lot of startups, where people sort of like have this fetish about the consumer market, and they like really want to do something that's like consumer-oriented and popular, and they miss all of the things that are – important but not popular. I mean, so there's a spectacular setup around here called Palantir that provides a startup. They're like a $2 billion company, but they're not public yet.
But you know, Palantir. I was actually skiing with him last.
Yeah, they're doing. You know, they're organizing the world's information when it comes to like government data and, you know, providing services to the government and to large organizations, you know, for data processing. I don't even know entirely what they're doing, but like, there's so much data out there. There's so much need for like companies that can help organizations and governments process, understand, you know, economic data, financial data, like, you know, shipping data. Like, there is this huge market out there for organizing the world's information. And that's what Google does really well. Google knows how to engineer that. Google knows how to design that. Google knows how to build that sort of, you know, product. That's what they should be going after, to me, not like the consumer market. They have a great consumer product, they do well with it, but that would do two things. First of all, it would hit at their core strength of what they can do engineering wise secondly, it would diversify their income streams away from, as Dwayne always likes to call it, their one trick pony of search and advertising. And this is basically just more advertising. Google wants advertise, which means that no matter how many different things they do, it all comes back to the same, you know, punchline and the same basic way of making money. And as soon as that changes, as soon as, you know, advertisers, you know, something else changes, then suddenly they're left high and dry without any other way of doing things. I don't know if that's going to change, but I still feel like, you know, if we're going to criticize them for being a one-trick pony, that's their one trick. It's a good trick, but...
And here's my thing. I don't actually, like, when it comes to Google and search, I'll claim that Wall Street chases them for being a one-trick pony. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think it's a problem that search is how they get their advertising dollars, that they have a money printing machine in search. I think that that's fine. I'm focused on focus. And when I look at what Google is, when I look at what Google's doing now, it's the lack of focus that you were talking about that gets me. So just to clarify, the one-trick pony is the pressure they have from Wall Street in order to, you know, have more products, more offerings, more whatevers. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's wrap up this discussion and get into our main topic here. But
sure.
But before
I just
want
to say.
Oh yeah,
one
yeah.
Last,
go ahead. Go ahead.
I just want to say that looking back at this this Apple Xerox thing,
mm-hmm.
Xerox was allowed to buy pre-IPO stock from Apple in exchange for engineer visits and an understanding that Apple would create a GUI product. That's what I meant by a fair exchange. Apple went over to Xerox. They paid. Xerox said, yeah, let's do it. Go ahead. That's why when Xerox went in, they tried to attack Apple for this. They got shut down. And that's the story that I was going for. I just wanted to make that clear because I didn't want it to come – I don't know. Right. I felt like it kind of came across like I made it all up. But that's the situation.
Well, you said they licensed it. They didn't.
It's a form of license to say I'm going to give you stock in exchange for an understanding that I'm going to create a GUI product based on what I see.
So why did Xerox sue them for copying their ideas?
Xerox, I don't know. They were under different management. They needed money. I don't know. But the bottom line is it was dismissed because of this understanding. Just like the Microsoft-Apple case was dismissed because in the end, the Apple 1.0 operating system was something that Microsoft had licensed certain aspects to. So that ended up being dismissed. But Apple was anathema. They were all angry, whatever, because they were like, this isn't just a question of you taking some concepts from us. This is you taking the whole entire thing from us and running with it. Xerox thought they could make some money doing that too, and it fell apart for both companies. The difference is if you look at Xerox PARC, yeah, there's some elements of the same, but the Apple OS is completely different. When you look at like what happened between Microsoft 3.1 and Windows 95, I mean, that changeover was almost akin to what we saw with the whole like Android going from a RIM focused device to an iPhone focused device. It was a big, and that's where the suit came from.
All right. Let's close this off. And before we get into our main topic here, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor, Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook I'd like to talk about this week is called Shadow of the Titanic, The Extraordinary Stories of Those Who Survived. Although we think we know the story of the Titanic, little has been written about what happened to the survivors after the tragedy. How did the loss of the ship shape the lives of the people who survived? How did those who were saved feel about those who perished? And how did they remember that terrible night? The book sheds new light on the unforgettable event by showing how the disaster continued to shape the lives of those passengers who escaped the sinking ship. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because two reasons. First of all, 100th anniversary of the Titanic disaster on April 15th.
Andy, that was a real thing?
Are you freaking did you see the Twitter? Did you see all the Twitter streams of the people who were like, "Wow, the James Cameron's movie was based on a real fact."
Wait, okay. So here's a question about that. I saw pictures of tweets, and I did some searching on Twitter itself. I was not able to find any actual Twitter links about that were actually saying that. I only saw a picture of tweets.
I've noticed this for a lot of things where like pictures of tweets become a little viral. People go back and kill those tweets or actually kill those accounts because I think they get a lot of like replies and people are like, "You are a freaking idiot," and they just leave Twitter. So I've noticed that too, Chris. Aww. Yeah.
And the thing is, sort of like people don't know, but you might tweet and might go to the Library of Congress, but in terms of like what you actually have on your Twitter stream, you can delete that as easily as a Facebook deletion. So people do that, you know. People go out there.
And the second reason that I wanted to bring this up was that I recently saw James Cameron's 3D post conversion of Titanic.
Really?
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
That's commitment, man. I saw that movie 3 times in theaters. I'll never see it again.
I want to see the 3D. It looked good from the trailers I saw.
It's only the second time I've ever seen the movie. The first time was the first time it was in the theater. And I wrote a write-up of my review of it on Geeks of Doom here, which I'll also post in the show notes. But it gave me an opportunity to kind of really drill down into some of the deficiencies of the plot that I felt were...
Oh, God. Like, yeah. Okay, it's a sinking ship. It's really dramatic. People are dying. But let's have a gunfight because it clearly can't be dramatic enough.
Don't give it away.
Well, there were a lot of problems that I had with the movie, but in general, I mean, I think it holds up, and I think it held up better than I even remembered.
Mm-hmm. How was the 3D? That's my main thing.
The 3D was not showy. It was very not. I don't want to say it was subtle, but it wasn't overly showy. So and not only that, but for being a post conversion, I felt it was probably one of the best examples that I've ever seen of a post conversion.
Oh, he went into that. He went into that deeply to talk. I remember he was on. He was both on NPR and some other outlet where he went into what it takes to make a true post conversion. It's not a question of 4 weeks in a team.
It took him like over a year.
Yeah, it took him a very long time. He focused a lot on that. And like, if I do see it, it would be because I want to see the difference in post-conversions out there. The reason I saw it 3 times is because I was doomed. There was a girlfriend. There was a best friend. There was a girlfriend.
Girlfriend, that's all you had to say.
There was a girlfriend. The girlfriend vomited the first time, so he had to leave it. And then it was a big
wow.
to-do. So I spent like 9 hours of my life with James Cameron. And
it was realistic.
It's a movie, but... so I paid money for it in the theater to see it all these times. Jack!
Anyway, let me play a little clip from Shadow of the Titanic here, written by Andrew Wilson and narrated by Bill Wallace.
For First Class Passenger Colonel Archibald Gracie, the RMS Titanic was a floating palace, a high-class hotel that cut through the waters of the Atlantic with a majesty and power he had never experienced before. As he stood on the first-class deck, he noticed that the sea was so level he could barely make out a ripple.
So that was a little clip from Shadow of the Titanic, The Extraordinary Stories of Those Who Survived. And that book, along with any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, can be yours to try out by going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook and your free trial. And I believe that they have extended their trial from 14 days to 30 days now. So you get 30 days to try out Audible's free trial on our dime, basically. So just, you know, go ahead and use that URL, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. It helps out our show, so it's a win-win for everybody. Okay, we're going to take a little break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about arguably one of the biggest startup purchases in the tech industry and the ripples that has affected Facebook's purchase of Instagram. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down Live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devendra Hardawar, Duane DeFreitas, Christopher Bernard, and we are going to discuss this huge Facebook purchase of Instagram, $1 billion. So Facebook has reached an agreement to buy Instagram for $1 billion in cash and stock. That means even before it launches its massive IPO, Facebook is using its market wealth to grow. Zuckerberg said, "We plan on keeping features like the ability to post other social networks, the ability to not share your Instagrams on Facebook if you want, and the ability to have followers and follow people separately from your friends on Facebook. This is an important milestone for Facebook because it's the first time we've ever acquired a product and a company with so many users. We don't plan on doing many more of these, if any at all, but providing the best photo sharing experience is one reason why so many people love Facebook and knew it would be worth bringing these two companies together." Now, the blogosphere is all a Twitter with
I can't believe you said that.
They're alive with reasons why Facebook might have had to purchase Instagram, but I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on that. Why you think they purchased Instagram? Mm.
Is this where I should talk about my theory from before the show?
Yeah. Absolutely.
My theory is that Zuckerberg just really wanted to write a $1 billion check, even though I know it wasn't actually a $1 billion check. But my theory.
He was
honestly
able to write that blog post, and he said we bought it for $1 billion, right? Or no, it was in the press release. It wasn't on the blog post. Mm-hmm. The price.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to say it right here. I think Zuckerberg was scared of it. Yeah. Like, I can see why Instagram would sell. I mean, like, you know, I'm sure they thought they were going to do really well. They probably were going to do really well. It's really hard to turn down $1 billion. I mean, like, what's the likelihood that they were going to become a $1 billion company? Even Twitter is not quite sure if it's a $1 billion company, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to turn that. And the question is what
Twitter
does Facebook
is far more of a proven service too. So
with income, yes. You know, like we used to make fun of Twitter for not having it, but at least they have income now. Mm-hmm.
At least they have an idea.
A big piece of this, looking at the blog post, looking at what I've seen around, I don't think this was a question of Facebook saying, "I got to get Instagram." I think there was some private behind the scenes bidding around this particular product. I think that during their funding, they were looking possibly for a buyer if the price was right. Yeah. And I think that they, you know, in some ways, there was an approach to Facebook people saying, "Hey, look, if you're interested in buying us, we're whatever." That's why when you read the blog post, he says, "We've agreed to buy Instagram for, you know, we've agreed to acquire Instagram." So that's not the Bravosi kind of like, we went out and we bought this puppy. That's a bit more, docile. And it kind of alludes to the fact that there was some negotiation here. And in fact, there was, because if Facebook were to have its druthers like they did with Gowalla, they bought Gowalla and they killed it. You know, it wasn't the only startup that they
bought.
Remember
Gowalla, guys?
Yeah, so I mean, there was another startup too that they bought and killed. I forgot what it was. They don't. Go ahead, Chris.
Beluga? I think.
They bought and killed Beluga. They made this messages thing that doesn't work.
Friendfeed is pretty much dead.
Friendfeed, they bought and killed Friendfeed. But with this, you know, Instagram had some chutzpah, and they were able to get in there and say, you know what, look, whether they said it to Zuckerberg himself or, you know, mm-hmm. to the Facebook, you know, M&A people, whatever, they're going to remain independent. And I think one of the reasons they are going to – like Facebook is okay with leaving them independent is because if you've ever tried to use the iPhone to take a picture with Facebook, it's not easy. And to go back to what Chris was talking about last time, the focus is key. Like he said that you kind of allude to the idea that you have to have a reason to exist. Instagram exists to make fun with photos, easy fun with quick photos. And if Facebook can get all the exit data and all the other data associated with you know, Instagram photos, and they can like more easily tie it into their systems, and people continue to use Instagram as the default camera on their telephones the way people have been with iPhones, Facebook gets all that action, plus they get, you know, possibly, you know, 10 million users that weren't on Facebook to begin with. Mm-hmm. So a big part of what's happening here, I think, is that this company, they focused solely on making one of the best camera apps for the iPhone. It's not Camera Plus, sure, but it's not for – they decided I'm not going to go for the photo.
It's social.
I'm going to make it social. I'm going to make it easy. And I'm going to go for the person who's not a photo aficionado, who doesn't really care about the most crisp whatever. In fact, mm-hmm. I'm going to make the photos less crisp because mm-hmm. they're more fun and they remind you of that analog Polaroid thing. And it's just kind of kitschy, but I'm going to keep on adding filters and yada, yada, yada. And Facebook went out and they tried to add filters in that stupid copycat kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I think when they saw the opportunity, they were like, look, we're gonna not only be able to take Instagram and get my army of engineers behind it, like true army of engineers behind it, so that we can do whatever we want to do with this. We're gonna be able to bring it to the Microsoft platform, where it's gonna get a lot of play. We're gonna be able to take some of the focus that those guys have and bring it to Facebook and many of the ways that sort of Google did with them getting that new designer to work on Ice Cream Sandwich for the operating system and put some more soul into it. And mm-hmm. you know, I think they made the right decision in openly saying many times, this is not – we're not just going to integrate everything into Facebook. This is going to be its own app. This is going to be its own thing.
Yeah. And it kind of has to be its own app, right? Because there are a couple things going on here. When Facebook announced that they would be going public, they listed mobile as, like, one of their biggest pain points because they didn't – like, you know, the Facebook mobile app is fine, but like Dwayne said, you know, taking pictures is tough. They've had trouble figuring out, like, what to do with mobile. Like, it's a great place to – see what's going on Facebook, but they don't know how to monetize it. They don't really know how to take advantage of it, even though an increasing number of their users are accessing Facebook through the phone.
Do you have numbers?
So mobile's
on that
always been a big problem.
Do you have numbers on the percentage of people who are accessing Facebook through mobile as opposed to
there were numbers. I think if you go look at the SEC filing for their IPO, there were some numbers. It was a significant chunk, and certainly, and the thing is, it's getting bigger. And the mm-hmm. big problem was that Facebook just didn't quite know what to do with them. So what Instagram does is that, first off, like it taps Facebook into this whole audience, right? This is 30 million users. This app has been out for, what, around a year? This is the fastest growing service we've ever seen, and certainly the fastest growing in terms of valuation. Like people were joking.
I don't know. YouTube was pretty big too. I mean, YouTube got picked up for $1.6 billion at the same amount of time after Instagram was made. So they've got the same time. And I think YouTube had 12 employees while Instagram had 13. Mm-hmm. So
and it's,
there's
well,
a lot
of its life. Instagram only had 4 employees too.
True, I agree with that.
Now
I guess
they've
all
got
I'm
13.
Saying is that like you look at Instagram, you look at YouTube, and we actually see two big companies on the rise. I forget when Google's IPO was, but I think it was right around. It wasn't too far away from when they picked up YouTube. Mm-hmm. And no, actually, it was after because I think it's 2009 they picked up YouTube. Bottom line is, YouTube gets picked up. YouTube is able, with that big price, they're still able to remain independent, and they've pretty much been independent ever since. So if that's any model for what we're seeing here, what mm-hmm. Zuckerberg's talking about, how it has to be different because it's fundamentally different type of user, different type of whatever, there's hope that Instagram will be able to remain as powerful, interesting, and whatever, the same way YouTube was after its mm-hmm. time.
Well, I mean,
YouTube was 2006.
Extent, yeah, 2006. To a certain
so the
extent,
IPO YouTube, was when,
2000. YouTube has become like a huge program, like a huge subsection within Google. So it's not mm-hmm. just like a couple of people anymore. So it's unclear mm-hmm. how this acquisition is going to affect Instagram. Hopefully it won't like remove the soul of the app, because I think I love Instagram. I love using it. And, you know, despite the problems that it sort of represents, like for photo taking and whatnot, My big problem with the acquisition, you know, I don't blame the guys for taking this, because once you see a figure like $1 billion for your old company, yeah. I can't think of anybody in the world who would turn that down. But my big problem is
Mark Zuckerberg?
That's a little different, because I think he knew what he was building, whereas the Instagram folks were like, guys, we're being valued at $1 billion, and we haven't even figured out a monetization plan
right.
yet. And even Facebook didn't at that point. But like, the potential was there. There's less potential in terms of monetizing Instagram. So
Right.
I don't know.
You're absolutely correct.
I don't want them to lose their soul, because that's what I love about Instagram. I love using
That's why it's so appealing.
Though. Yeah.
Yeah.
If Zuckerberg said, you know, he wants to use their soul and bring that into Facebook. So that's a good sign.
If Facebook does nothing else other than integrate Facebook cross integration,
like the Borg, Facebook will assimilate. You know, it'll just suck in everything.
I mean,
which is what Facebook tends to do. I mean, that's why it's hard to believe that like a year or two from now, like Instagram is still going to be an independent product released by Facebook. It's really hard.
I look back to YouTube.
Yeah, but that's a totally different company. I mean, like,
that was before the
Facebook
app economy.
Google are extremely different companies in terms of their approaches. I have to admit, YouTube is a little bit of an unusual aspect, but
Google has acquired lots of companies, and they've integrated all those companies into them. With the exception of YouTube, and I think that YouTube is a key differentiator in so many ways. Just like how Facebook had its own take a picture from your mobile phone. Google had its own video service. They had to wind down because they just knew that the way YouTube did it was
just so much better.
And I think that's what Facebook is seeing here. And I think that's what the text that we have access to is also showing us, that they just, Instagram does this particular thing so much better. Again, to lean on what Chris was saying last time about Google and how they don't have the focus and reasoning being and all this other stuff like that. I think Zuckerberg sees how this program is getting people to interact online, to share social graph data, to be social. And these guys' focus was so tight that they don't even have a regular web experience. They are only on this phone. Mm-hmm. And they were only on one phone for so long in order to just make it that much, that tight. And I think that's
that
culture.
And they reached 5 million more users on Android in 1 week. Like,
in 1 week.
Their growth numbers are unbelievable. Yeah. Their growth numbers, they've been from like 0 to 30 million users in 18 months. I mean, that is just unbelievable on one phone platform.
Yeah, and that's really what Facebook is buying, right? Like, this whole acquisition shows that users are far more valuable than actual, like, any monetization plan.
So I'm confused, though. I mean, is Facebook really banking on the fact that these are users that are new?
They don't have.
Like, how many Instagram users out there are that aren't Facebook users?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't think that the users are the draw as much as the following is the draw. The talent, because we've seen these guys, like the Facebook and its opponents, go after talent in a big way. I think the way it's not so much the users, it's the way they're able to draw the users. They're able to pull in users somehow, some way. And Facebook wants to tap into that. They want to leverage that talent to get that kind of action on Facebook so that Facebook truly can hit that, you know, multiple billions of users on their own site. And I think also, you know, if you're the default camera for both phones, you're getting so much information. You take out Flickr, you take out, you know, iPhone.
Well, you take out Facebook photos.
Take out,
I mean, like,
because, you know, you've got this thing.
Sorry, you cut out for a second. I didn't realize you were still talking.
Sorry,
I think,
go ahead.
I agree entirely. I think that. I mean, I still get back to that. I think that like Zuckerberg saw this as a very serious threat to Facebook. As you were saying, Facebook is weak in mobile. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, I'm not happy with their mobile app, even on the iPhone. The whole interface freezes whenever it's loading something in the background, which it's always doing. And more importantly, I mean, Facebook is at this point, you know, very much of a photo sharing application. I mean, amongst other things, but that's seriously one of the most popular things on it. It's certainly the thing I do the most on Facebook is find photos of my friends, like, you know, that and link sharing. And the fact that they were able to do this in such a short period of time with a extremely limited platform and with huge growth numbers meant that, you know, they could very quickly, you know, become, you know, I mean, we always get back to the fact it's about eyeball time. And, you know, if they're spending, people are spending that much more time on Instagram than on Facebook, and mm-hmm. that's becoming their primary social network, that's really scary for Facebook, especially when it hits their primary, you know, one of their primary things that they do.
And it doesn't touch half the stuff that they do, right? Like, Facebook has this amazing way of tracking everything you've ever done and telling you about when there's an update to that particular thing. Yeah. Instagram's like, yeah, take a photo. They forget about it. You can take another one later. Like, fundamentally different approaches to
user's experience. I really feel like there's a lesson for Google here, like, relating to Plus. Like, Instagram...
Throw more money at promising companies.
No, I mean from Instagram's point of view. Like, Instagram, I feel like, built a social network the way you should build a social network.
Instagram built a social network in a cave with a box of scraps, guys.
Exactly.
You know,
like, so one thing
they weren't in Silicon Valley either, guys.
You know, that's an interesting point, and something I made a little bit before we went on air is that, like, I feel a little bit of Schadenfreude for startups like Path and Color, who like really spent a lot of energy trying to engineer.
Oh, Color didn't spend any energy. Let me just make.
Wait,
that
when
clear.
You say Schadenfreude, you mean like you're laughing at those guys?
A little bit, because... a little bit, because they tried super hard to come upon the success that Instagram did just serendipitously. I mean, Instagram's they practically fell into their success by mm-hmm. accident. And I think it was just a matter of that just goes to show you that you can't, like, to go to take a page from the film industry. Nobody knows nothing. you can't predict.
Well, I also think.
Yeah, go ahead.
Paths, I mean, Instagram's model was like, hey, take a picture, follow. Here's our favorites page. Follow whoever you want. They had focus, but it was kind of artificial. Like, you can only have 50 people. Okay, we'll make it 100. You can only do this. You can only do that. And there was a lot of only. Whereas with Instagram, it's like there was always a feeling of, yeah, we just haven't built that yet. You know? You don't mm-hmm. know what was coming, but you knew it was going to get better and better. And having focused simply on that particular platform, on the one platform, I think that it really did get better. It was, and to me, just said it was made in a cave. That was part of its success. Part of what went on was, you know, they were going to sit back and go in some cave and figure out something that they wanted to use, and it's going to be different and weird. It's weird. It's pretty weird, Instagram. It's going to be different and weird, and it's not going to be like anything you've ever seen. And that's the accomplishment that I'd like to see more in software, just like stuff I've never seen, new ways of using it, new text, new whatever. I think that's how you. That's part of how you get there. Of course, you have to can't keep your head in the sand forever. But the minute they pop their head up, somebody snapped up for $1 billion.
Because there were other photo sharing and photo filter apps. Like, I feel really bad for the other folks. What was it, Hipstagram and a couple of the others? Although now they've kind of come up with a Hipstamatic. I'm thinking Hipstagram. But mm-hmm. Hipstamatic, like, they're forming a partnership with Instagram now to send stuff to Instagram because they know they can't win. There's just nowhere to go. At this point, I don't know. Exactly. And what was compelling to me about the whole Instagram thing is that it wasn't the first, and it maybe even wasn't necessarily the best, but it was the easiest. You know, it was one of those services where you take a picture, you put a filter on it, you send it to your friends. Yay! That's it. That's all you got to worry about. And they replicated that whole addictive mentality. They built their own social network. Within it, and that's key too. I've seen a lot of app companies who are now trying to figure that out. Like one of the news ones, it's not Pulse, it's not Tap2, it's one of the other like newsreader apps. Like, they're working on building accounts now where you'll have a stream of data, and you can share stuff with your friends. That whole idea of having a profile within these apps is actually very powerful, and Instagram just kind of built on that pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting here also is that like the attention for the last several months has been on Pinterest. Yeah, Instagram's coming out with the Android app, but they were pretty quiet about that until they announced it at South by Southwest, and everyone got excited. But Pinterest, it shows up almost out of nowhere last summer. You know, it has a money-making strategy out the gate, which is so rare for one of these things. It's kind of web-focused. It just came out with the iPhone app, so many months ago. But all this, I think one of the things that's shocking about this was, you know, you see Pinterest, all this stuff is surrounding Pinterest. And then suddenly, suddenly Instagram is the bell of the ball with the you know, Prince Charming buying it for $1 billion. And we're kind of like, oh, but wait, I thought Pinterest was the hot thing. So I think we were all kind of thrown off. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. They just raised $500 million like 2 weeks ago. So I guess they were sort of on.
Sure, that's what I'm saying, yeah. Though. Like, you think all the attention was on Pinterest, and then Instagram comes out of nowhere. Yeah, they raised some money. Yeah, they got some whatever. But Pinterest was kind of like the social network to watch. In fact, yeah. I don't think people even thought of Instagram as a social network as much as they thought about it as like a photo app.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One thing we haven't mentioned, and I'm not a finance guy, so I don't know the specifics of this, but the way the whole Instagram thing seemed to work out was that, you know, they were working on this funding before, right? This sort of $50 million of funding that was going to value them at $1 billion. And they closed mm-hmm. that. So they were working to close that while also negotiating the Facebook deal. And the way they timed it was that, you know, the investors who put in this $50 million quickly saw a return from this Facebook purchase, like within 2 days. It's ridiculous.
That's VC happiness. That's VC.
Oh my god.
That's like the VC. Like, you don't go with VCs are basically like mobsters when it comes to like investing.
That's like a rainbow. So that's the way to turn it. You only see this once in your life.
Right.
And the people involved were like, okay, glad we were here.
yeah.
They tripped and fell onto it. Right.
Exactly.
Like, ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think all of us are probably like. We were all like a little shocked, but definitely pleased.
I'm happy for them.
At least the way this is being sold, the fact that the people can sit in their basement or their warehouse or wherever, come up with a good idea that people like, and we can all still be surprised being in tech. Because a lot of times we don't get surprised. We see things happening far way out. There's like it's rote. It's already decided. It's going to have to happen X way or Y way. And this was just a nice surprise that you could still make it. Cinderella story.
Yeah, I'm happy for them, and like Devendra, I hope that they don't lose their soul. I hope that they're able to hold on to that, you know, that individuality. And they really don't need much to do what they're doing. All they need to do is scale up, right?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about Instagram, guys. Like, so for the past year, like when we write a story about Instagram or we wanted to comment or something, you just email the CEO. Like, he's a guy down the street. You just email him and you say, hey, what's up? Or you, like, arrange a phone chat. I don't know if that sort of, like, closeness with the tech community is even going to be there anymore because of this. Like, I wonder if Facebook is going to start putting up its firewalls between, you know, Kevin Systrom and the press and everything. There was that sort of local mentality to Instagram that I think is going to be lost. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
How long do you think it'll take for them to grow as a company? Like, they're like, what, 13 people now? Yeah, they have access to all these Facebook engineers and everything like that. How long do you think it'll be before they're like a 200-person company? Like, I wonder, you know, like
it
what kind of growth
division,
you think we'll see in terms of that?
Right? It would be a 200-person division within Facebook. I don't know. That's, like, you're right. They don't need too many people. What they need is resources. They need a crap ton of resources to
servers.
Like, keep,
tons of servers.
To scale. And I think that's one of the things
we know
on
like,
Android for so long, right? If they can focus on the iPhone, a fairly relatively. It's a big market, but it's a controllable market. You know how many iPhone users you're preparing for, in a sense. But when you throw in Android, that's like shit hits the fan at that point.
Yeah.
And let's not forget that Windows Phone, built by Microsoft, one of Facebook's biggest investors, earliest investors. Microsoft's probably going to leverage this new relationship in order to get Instagram or Windows Phone pretty quickly.
Oh, sure.
Like, some of those Facebook resources are going to be going just for building a Windows Phone kind of focused UI for the Instagram situation.
I'm sure they're probably working on something probably to coincide with like the Apollo Windows Phone update at the end of this year, like in the fall. Mm-hmm. So there's that. I'm sure there's an Instagram Windows 8 app in the works or something. Like, Instagram actually doesn't have a great tablet platform yet. Like, they don't have any good tablet apps. Running it on the iPad, you kind of have to blow up the iPhone app. On the new iPad, it looks fine, but you're still looking at it at a lower resolution. So what they need to, at this point, I think they're going to focus on is like the iPad experience before they even think about Windows Phone.
Makes sense.
They don't have to stop at anything now. That's the thing. They don't have to stop at anything now.
Yeah, I have to admit,
go ahead, Chris.
I guess I have to admit, like, I am happy for them in one way. In some ways, I'm not happy. I find it sad when you have something that has, you know, extreme promise and extreme interest and extreme, you know, difference is sort of standing out, that just sort of goes and sort of just joins one of the larger companies again. Like, I guess it's sort of the same way I feel about OMG Pop, like joining Zynga. Like, as much as I can't really fault the people who've done it in any way, I feel like competition is a good thing. And I love it when, you know, some scrappy little startup comes out of nowhere and just does something awesome. And I'm just sort of like, well, you did something awesome. Keep doing it. It's like, it's like a, you know, an awesome, like, football player sort of coming up and being like, okay, that's pretty cool. I'm going to join the Patriots. You know, it's like, I want to see, like, somebody, you know, join something else.
But this is the conundrum when it comes to, like, tech and art and things like this. You show up with something that's really creative, really awesome. Someone says, hey, what do you do? Well, I make a mobile app. It's free? Yeah. You know, I'm in my basement. I'm doing whatever. I'm relatively starving. But I'm making this art. I'm making this app. And suddenly the record producer comes and says, you make good stuff. Let me give you this deal. And then you become rich, and then suddenly everyone's like a sellout. So either you become the starving artist or, like, the small programmer, and people are, like, not taking you seriously, or you get picked up and you do really well by way of Instagram, record producer, whatever, and then suddenly everyone thinks you're a sellout. In the end, I think this is going to let – and that's, like, a paradigm that's really painful. And in the end, I think this is going to let more people experience the joy of Instagram, at least in the short term. I think it's going to go for the long term too, but we know, I think, all of us, that for the short term, more people are going to get to experience the joy of Instagram, and that's right. That's kind of a good thing.
Yeah, we should probably wrap this topic soon. Yeah. I just want to say, I think this is probably the best possible outcome for Instagram, at least for Instagram, right? For the people involved, there's still relatively small number of employees. They get probably the best freaking offer that they would have ever gotten. Because where are the alternatives, right? Apple buying them? Apple has never proven that they can do a cross-platform thing very well. They always tend to focus on making their products the best on iOS or Mac or whatever.
Right.
And they bought
Microsoft. Microsoft doesn't know what to do with innovative services. It takes them a while. They're really slow. Google, if the Google bought Instagram, they would have no clue what to do with this company. I feel like that would have been even bigger mess. And if Instagram had stayed on their own, like, I think eventually, like, their valuation probably would have dropped as they realized they couldn't monetize on their own.
Right.
And the business plan kind of would just fizzle. And so it seems like they went out on their peak, and for them it's probably the best possible thing. I just hope for the users,
again, guys,
they don't get screwed too.
Well, let's finish
again,
up this
a
top.
Lot of these companies are made just for selling. They're made, you know, like, part of this is the exit strategy is, I'm going to build it. Somebody bigger than me is going to come up, and they're going to find a better use for this technology. I'm just going to focus on this thing and be sold.
Let's finish up this topic. I want to ask one question that's kind of bouncing around the internet as well. So do you feel like a billion dollar acquisition of a small startup is a portend of a tech bubble?
I mean, it shows us that some companies have way too much money these days. Like, I think Facebook can pretty much, they can spend this and not really worry too much. The bubble talk is inevitable, but for me, the bigger bubble talk is when useless companies like Color get a crap ton of funding and buzz for absolutely nothing. So I am pleased that Instagram at least had something great.
It makes sense.
They were the best at what they did.
Yeah.
And yeah, it makes sense. Maybe not the amount of money, but you know, they deserve whatever they got.
I mean, part of the thing
if Instagram
right
moved
is
up by $400 million, we'd all be like, "Oh, that's a good price for it." Yeah. So I think there is a bit of a. I can see why people are freaking out about this bubble.
Yeah.
But I also think that we're in an age of, I think the bubble is yet to be. I think the bubble is yet to be determined when it comes to things like the Facebook IPO. I mean, I saw Groupon. We also had Coming a Mile Away with their IPO. And we thought this is janky. They are not worth what they're saying they are worth. With Facebook, we'll see if the confidence will stay in that company and that platform and what they do, and we'll see if there truly is a bubble. Because if they go down, they're going to take a whole bunch of other companies with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people think bubble, I think they think back to the .com. And as much as there might be some serious economic problems with the current sort of state of startups, it's a very different sort of world and a different sort of bubble from what you have with the .com boom. I mean, like, there you had huge amounts of leverage on the public markets. So, like, when they went down, there was a huge amount of non-related investors that get hurt by this. I mean, if this bubble pops, like, who's going to get hurt? Like,
yeah,
the Sequoia, Greylock, the Angels.
Yeah,
like
I mean, a lot of these companies aren't public enough to get. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a very big difference. And I think the second thing is to keep in mind is, I mean, interest rates are ridiculously low right now. Like, and this is logically what you're going to see. If it's extremely easy to take out a loan, then goodness, if I have the resources to take out a loan, I'm going to do it and I'm going to invest in something. And that's going to drive up the price of investing in things.
Yeah.
And combine that with the fact that, you know, the startup tech world is doing substantially better than the rest of the economy. Mm-hmm. It means that you're going to have a huge amount of startups and a huge amount of companies investing in those startups.
And this is also like, there's also like to further Chris's point, this is an engine of growth. Like the app economy has built lots and lots and lots and lots of jobs with mom and pop shops making apps. And I think that the reason for that is because as people explore mobile, it's not yet a world where there's only a few whatevers. There's a lot of people out there. What I am worried about, you know, Chris said that when the dot-com thing happened, people's 401ks and everything got hurt. Again, once Facebook goes public, all the mutual funds are going to run to it. A lot of people are going to run to Facebook and start buying a lot of Facebook stock. The stock might, you know, might go up by a lot. And I think that people will be heavily leveraged in their retirement funds and other things for Facebook stock. You know, inside like a 6 or 9 month period after Facebook IPOs. And that's, I think, when we really will see if there's a dot-com bubble. I don't think
I know. One thing I want to see more of is talk of like multiple surface. Smaller bubbles that could potentially pop, because that's what I'm seeing, right? I think social games, as it is, social games cannot last. Like the money they're
social
bringing
games
in,
and
because
and
they're essentially tricking users, right? I hate social games. I hate everything about them. So yeah, if your retirement fund is sort of based around
you hate draw something,
probably get the fuck out of there. But you know, other things too, like location and other companies, other sorts of like little niches that are being focused on right now. I think location is probably the biggest growth that we're going to see over the next couple of years.
Yeah. You know, it's funny though. Everyone thought location was going to be the big thing, and I mean, I guess one thing that's really a watermark about this is you can make the point. This is essentially the first $1 billion mobile company.
Sure.
And that's a really big milestone. I mean,
natively
we're
mobile,
still.
Yeah.
Yeah, and natively and exclusively mobile. And I think that it's funny. We all thought it was going to be Foursquare or you know, some other location-based thing, and it turns out to be cameras. I don't know. Maybe there is not as much to location as we thought there was going to be, or maybe it just hasn't been killed in the right way.
I think, well, there are a couple things here. You look at, like, Foursquare. And Foursquare was in a market with Gowalla, and there was another guy out there. And, of course, Facebook had its check-ins. And Foursquare is the only one to really survive that as a location-focused, native location situation. Then you look at, like, the camera, right? Canon was in charge of the camera, you know, with Olympus on one side and Panasonic and Sony on the other side. And with the advent of the phones doing what they're able to do, those sales are dropping off. People are really using – they're replacing their cameras with their telephones. So I think one of the big things here is if you can have an app that does that and, like, lets you do all the stuff that you would normally – that you'd want to do on your old camera – but that would involve you plugging it into your computer and sucking down the photos and opening up this program and doing whatever. If you can do even a fraction of that from your phone immediately, which we've seen Apple do with the iPhoto and then, like, you know, get the red eye out and all sorts of stuff like that. But if you can do that with your telephone, I mean, that's a huge, huge thing. I think that's where a lot of the value comes from. We've forgotten that there was a whole market for 3.5-inch cameras in people's pockets. It's just falling by the wayside. So it's not like this is coming out of nowhere. It's stealing the lunch of the traditional point-and-shoot market, and that's why it's kind of important.
Yeah, I agree.
We got to wrap up this topic so we can get into the final word here. So let's take a little break here, listen to a little bit of music here, and when we come back, we're going to ask the question, is the age of cheap cell phones over? So take a listen to this and come on back. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini, and I'm here with Devinder Hardwar, Dwayne DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernor. And now, Dwayne, you brought this topic up here. You wanted to ask, is the age of cheap cell phones over, and you see a trend based on certain watermarks that you're seeing here. You want to explain your thesis behind this theory?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's less of a theory and more of just like a question. You know, for a long time, Europe has focused on this idea that cell phones are something that you buy, take to any carrier, do whatever you want to do. In America, it's been totally different thing. I remember in 2009, I was talking to a private equity guy talking about how I want my BlackBerry to run on everything. No, I was 2007, actually, 2006. He's like, it'll never happen in America. It'll never happen in America. I thought, okay, maybe it won't. Maybe we're not culturally able to do that. I mean, the iPhone comes out. You spend $300. You get, over the course of an 18-month or two-year contract, you pay off X amount of dollars every single month. Basically, I called up AT&T and I found that, you know, it's $265 for me to break off my iPhone 4S contract right now. But every month that drops by $15, and to the point where, you know, the contract is expired, there's no termination fee any longer. So I remember earlier this year in March, T-Mobile, you know, Deutsche Telekom, it's a German company, they own T-Mobile USA. And the T-Mobile exec came out and said the era of cheap cell phones should end, that people should buy phones and use them on whatever network, and the network should compete on service and service alone, whether it's customer service or it's like, you know, service, wireless service to the telephone or whatever. You know, it's the subsidized telephone is eating away at what's best for the consumer. Then you find out that, you know, you come to find out a month later, AT&T is like, you know what? If you have an unlocked iPhone, whether if you have an iPhone out of contract, whether you paid to terminate your contract or you bought one or what. Or you know, you bought 1 year ago or whatever, we're gonna network unlock your telephone, which is actually different than buying the unlocked phone from Apple. If you bought the unlocked phone from Apple, you could definitely use it overseas, no problem, whatever. But there were still some issues people were having with using it on separate networks in the United States. So AT&T says, you're out of contract, you paid for your phone, your phone's fully paid for, we will unlock you in terms of network. And at first you're like, okay, whatever. I mean, who's gonna buy an unlocked phone? Who's unlocking their phone to go somewhere else, whatever? But then you find out T-Mobile comes back and says, look, now that AT&T is doing that, look, we're promising that by the end of this year, everyone will have full 3G access to all of their phones, to any phone, any iPhone, whatever, that's a GSM phone that's coming from AT&T, which is a huge leap because it means that they have to change the way their frequencies are working, the way they're doing a whole bunch of stuff in order to accommodate this phone. Their wish of this cheap cell phone is coming out. Then the Apple stock gets downgraded suddenly because – the investors are beginning to worry that, you know, the carriers aren't going to subsidize phones as much anymore. This happened yesterday. We saw Apple's stock was downgraded from buy to neutral on fears that subsidized telephones would not be the norm in the future. And then right after that, Verizon announced that they have a $30 upgrade fee, which is another barrier to entry for someone looking to get a subsidized telephone from Verizon. Even if it's subsidized, you know, it's a $200 phone, you have a contract, you're still paying $230 now, which is a barrier to entry for some people.
I feel like nobody's going to pay full price for an iPhone. You know, like given the opportunity, the competition in the marketplace will win out. Like people will go with whatever the cheapest phone is, the cheapest, best smartphone is.
Yeah.
I think that used to be the case. I used to really agree with that idea. But what I think we're finding is that people get really particular about the experience they want. And if they're like, I want that new iPhone, it's become a thing. People are in lines. There's shortages. You know, there's pre-orders. There's all this other stuff going around it. I think people are saying, I want an iPhone, and I'm going to pay, you know, $400 for my iPhone, $500 for my iPhone. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold on to that phone for longer. I'm going to hold on to that phone not just for a year. I'm going to hold on to that phone for 18 months, for 2 years, for 2.5 years, because the quality is good enough. I don't need the new thing all the time. But when I do upgrade, I want the nice thing. I don't really care how much it costs because I've been waiting for so long. I mean, people are already paying $200 every year to upgrade their iPhone. So if
not
you're
going
to upgrade your iPhone
every
year.
Just crazy people like us.
No, people are people. I'm not saying
everyone. That's not the mainstream thing.
No, it isn't the mainstream. I don't think this is for the mainstream at all. I think the whole purchasing of SIM cards and everything. This is for the early adopters. This is maybe for people who are coming in internationally and used to this paradigm. I'm not saying that I have a conclusion here. I'm just saying that there's some signs pointing to an industry moving toward a less subsidized phone as opposed to a not subsidized phone.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, the idea of subsidizing the phones happened, you know, in the early days because it was a way of getting people on to networks who didn't have phones. I mean, cell phones used to be extremely expensive, and it was a good model to make sure that everyone was on it. But, you know, now sort of having a cell phone, having an up-to-date cell phone is enough of an important thing for enough of the population that the subsidies don't seem to be needed as much anymore. It's unfortunate to me that, like, exactly. It seems like the subsidies are going away, but I don't see any like corresponding drop in the cost of service to make up for it. It's just sort of things cost more now.
This is what the T-Mobile guy was complaining about too. Like he was saying that subsidized phones are the biggest problem of the industry right now. The thing is, they're in so deep that I don't know they can really ever dig themselves out.
Right.
These phones cost a lot of money, guys. Right. So it's like the iPhone, right? Mm-hmm. If you were to pay full price for that, it would cost you, you know, for like the 16 gig version, it would cost you what, around $500 or $600?
Yep.
A lot more. Right. And right now, you know,
it costs
we're used
about as
to,
much as a handheld used to cost.
Sure. But now we're used to $200 high end smartphones.
Genie's
out
of the bottle.
Has been a huge and that's driven the smartphone, you know, revolution in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. Like, it's not heavily subsidized elsewhere, but they've still figured out ways to make them cheaper, to make more people buy them. And we actually just passed the point where 50% of mobile phone users in the U.S. own smartphones, or it's like 49.7% right now. So we're like right at the precipice. So that would never have happened without subsidies. We can't go back to a time when people are going to be paying over $400 for the iPhone. Like, as much as people want them, they're not going to be doing that. So, you know, what we see is that, Verizon...
That's why Apple was downgraded. I think what we're looking at is, economically speaking, a carrier is going to say, I can charge... Like, the carrier prices are going down. T-Mobile's already down. Other carriers are looking at ways to grow their profits because they've got to, you know, show growth when it comes to their stock.
Right.
Their stockholders. So what they do is they say, okay, we're going to subsidize the iPhone just a little bit less, but, you know, $50, whatever. So your default iPhone is $250. Because we know the crack is out there. People want the damn iPhone, and they're going to spend $50 extra to get it. They'll figure out what the number is based on, like, demand. It might be $225. It might go up, whatever. But they'll figure that number out, and then they'll maintain the same cost of service. So they're actually making, you know, $40 more per person. And that's going to make their entire bottom line go up. I think that's the economics that I'm looking at when I see this. If this were to occur, this is the economics behind why that would occur. Because the phone companies, the carriers, want to make more margin. And they know that the people are hooked now. Just like, you know, we were hooked on – we've been hooked on all sorts of stuff before. We were hooked on cable. Cable was cheap. Now they're saying cable is going to be, what, $200-something dollars by the for basic cable or, like, you know, one premium channel by the year 20-something. And it's kind of like, I think they're saying, we know people want these things. We know that they're made of good enough quality to hang out or whatever, and we know that we can get more margin. So we're going to see what we can do and test the waters. And I think that the T-Mobile guys are excited about this, and they're probably going to try to affect this change more quickly than anyone. But they're also probably getting their lunch stolen on subsidizing telephones because they can't afford to.
Yeah. So what we're seeing with the Verizon, like the $30 upgrade fee there, that's mainly targeted at people, you know, current subscribers who are going to a new phone that requires a subsidy and that they're going to sign a 2-year contract for. So, like, they're going to get a certain amount of money back. I just reported on some analyst firm. They said that, you know, this could potentially save Verizon $1 billion over the next year, assuming that, like, 33 million people upgrade their phones within the next year. That's a significant chunk of money. One thing that I think we'll definitely see die is the crazy-ass early upgrade thing that they've been doing for iPhone users. AT&T started doing this because iPhone users are addicted. They want to upgrade. They can't wait for the full 2 years. So they let people, you know, upgrade a little earlier, like maybe a year and a half or a year and a couple months.
18 months, yeah.
Yeah, you can sign a new 2-year contract. And that sort of thing, that is killing AT&T because, like, you're not fully completing your original contract. You're starting a new contract early, and they're basically, you know,
that's kind of a numbers game, though, because they're kind of like, AT&T as they've tried to just catch up with Verizon in usership, there's been a, like, you know, AT&T was always willing to do the things Verizon wasn't. So they got the iPhone, even though Verizon was like, yeah, no, I need my rules around my phone, right? And they that was a really big risk and win for them. I think it was also a big risk and win to get people to, you know, they wanted to pull attrition from Verizon because of the awesomeness of this phone. And I think they did that by letting people know that, like, hey, you can upgrade early on ours as long as you, like, re-up or whatever. And I think that that's the thing that kept people around, even when the network was as crappy as it has been. I mean, we all remember that. So I feel like that's – it was a gamble. And I'm not – I guess what you're saying – I'm guessing that what you're saying is that the gamble isn't paying off anymore because they're not exclusive to the phone any longer, or are you saying something separate?
I do think that there's a sense in which it's just like the market forces have got to the point where it's just there's not any good reasons for the companies to continue to subsidize the phones. And I mean, let's forget. I mean, when the iPhone first came out, people paid full price for it. Like, it wasn't subsidized at all. And I think that the carriers looked at that and they said, wait a minute, people are willing to actually spend $600 for a phone? I mean, remember everyone made – a few people, but enough people that I'm sure it got the carriers thinking, goodness, this is a substantial chunk of change that we can add, you know, to our profit margins. And, you know, I don't even think this is an example of them being evil. It's just – it's good business. It's unfortunate for us as consumers, but I can't really fault them as though, like, we shouldn't be paying for these phones that cost a lot of money that we
have. Yeah, there's something about knowing how much something actually costs.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's unfortunate, but, you know.
I think the genie's out of the bottle. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's wishful thinking on the carrier's
part. It's too late, yeah.
So let's wrap this up here. Let me go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Davindra. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Twitter.com/Davindra, VentureBeat.com/film.com, and Davindra.org.
All right, Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not here?
Find me at Twitter.com/DwayneD, Flavors.me/DwayneD, and G+TO/DwayneD.
All right, and lastly, Chris, what about yourself? Where can we find you?
You can find me probably most easily on Twitter at Chris Burnor, CHRISBURNOR. And then everything else I do is on most everything else I do is on Startup Digest, where I am co-curating our list of the best startup related articles for the week. Everything else is on chrisburnor.com, although I have got to admit I don't really publish there that often.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or G+.to/MrBabyMan, and that's my G+ link. And now that I know where the hangouts are, I'm probably going to be hanging out there a lot more often. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Just go to geeksofdoom.com, and we're in the right-hand sidebar at the very top, so easy to find. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of these stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful The Drill Down audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.